Hi, I'm Tamar Rodney, and you're listening to On the Pulse, a podcast from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into the experiences of frontline providers and researchers. We explore their insights and invaluable stories of how healthcare works in today's world. It's Palliative Care Month, and in today's show, we will be talking about death and dying with dignity, with Dr. Rebecca Wright, an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, Dr. Danetta Sloan, an associate scientist at the School of Public Health, and Dr. David Wu, an associate professor at the School of Medicine. Dr. Wu is also the director of the Palliative Care Program at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. In 2018, Dr. Wright, Dr. Wu, and Dr. Sloan founded the Palliative Interprofessional Collaborative for Action Research, or PICAR. It's an interprofessional team of clinicians and researchers that spans Bayview and the schools of nursing, public health, and medicine. They conduct research to respond to challenges that rise in practice for Bayview's palliative care program. So, although there is usually a 15 to 17 year delay in getting research into practice, PICAR is able to answer real questions in real time with evidence-based solutions. This year, PICAR even helped the palliative care program earn the highest honor a palliative care program can win in the U.S., the Circle of Life Award from the American Hospital Association. So today we're going to be talking about the incredible work that PICAR and the palliative care program are doing, turning research into practice, including real people in research design, and how their work improves disparities in care for people with serious chronic illnesses. Welcome, Dr. Wu, Dr. Sloan, and Dr. Wright.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to be with you.
Wonderful. And can I just say congratulations on your wonderful award? And this question I'll start out with is to all of you. What is the status quo for palliative care, and what are some of the common concerns? And specifically, how did it drive you to create PICAR? Dr. Wu, if I could start with you.
There's really been an impressive foundation built of evidence and of an upstream movement. So there's hospice and end-of-life care that most people know about, but palliative care has really defined itself as being upstream of that and taking care of patients with serious illness at any stage. And there's been a foundation of evidence built demonstrating impact on such metrics as quality and cost.
Wonderful. And Dr. Sloan, could you tell us from your perspective, how did it influence your drive to create PICAR?
Thank you. As a trained social worker and formerly in direct practice for about 10 years in the community through hospice and palliative care, there has been much stride in bringing palliative care to the awareness of people. However, in working with research participants in the community, I found that often people just don't know what it is. And those that do don't know how to access it. There's a lack of access. And then the engagement piece. How do people engage with clinicians once they reach the hospital and learn more about palliative care? So PICAR has been able to, I believe, fill that gap.
And Dr. Wright, from your perspective and the work you do, what are some of the common concerns with your role specifically on the team that led you to create PICAR?
So I sort of speak from the research side. I'm a palliative care nurse by background. But one of the challenges for our field is that many of the traditional methodologies for carrying out research are not really fit for purpose often for tackling the different problems and challenges that we see. Depending on where people are in the trajectory of their condition, it would not be appropriate to always try and do randomized control trials and so on. And that, coupled often with there has been a lack of funding, although this has changed in more recent years, and often concerns and gatekeeping around the appropriateness of trying to involve or inviting people to participate in research, meaning that there are often a lot of gaps. And what I was finding in my own practice was when I really tried to find out what is it that people want and need, those data just weren't really there. And so PICAR offered the opportunity for the interprofessional connection to bring together the academic and the clinical side, and having this kind of housing of resources where we could support the inclusion of patients and families. And then coming from the action research side, using those types of methodologies that are deliberately designed to be inclusive, participatory, and supportive of the people who are involved. So you're working with people, not on them or at them or about them. And so the drive has really been to build these partnerships, these communities, so that when we're then feeding back into clinical practice, we can really say, yeah, this is what we've been told people want and need. And it was that absence of information that was behind my driver for this group.
Thank you so much. And just building up one of the terminology that you mentioned just now, Dr. Wu, can you tell us from the work you do, what are some of the common concerns that you saw?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on what Dr. Wright was saying, that I think we all share this driving question: how do we make sure we're aligning the care to our diverse communities, our diverse patients and families? And I think the palliative care field has done a lot, but there remains that gap. How do we make sure that we are tailoring the care appropriately for our diverse communities? And what better way to do that, or what other way to do that, than to tailor the care by the diverse communities in co-design? And that's a lot of what drives our work. It's a lot of what brought us all together.
And I can hear the passion in your voice, because obviously this is a difficult topic and a difficult time for many individuals. So Dr. Sloan, if I could come to you. One of the struggles that we're having here is the time it requires for research to get to practice. And one of the numbers that is quite jarring is this 15 to 17 years. But when you're caring for someone who is seriously ill, we don't have that much time. They won't be around to see the action. So can you tell me what exactly is meant by action research?
Sure. Thank you for the question. Action research is really when we are including the population that we are developing programs for in the development of the program. So what that may look like is, while we are assessing and researching to understand what the challenges are, at the same time, we're asking those participants that's providing the information to us, we can receive guidance from the specific population in the tailoring process, and also implement programs along the way. And it takes much less time, less than 15 years, of course. We use two different approaches in our work. In the hospital, mostly we use the experience-based co-design methodology. And in the work in the community, we use community-based participatory research. They both look a little different, but the strengths are the same. The community-based approach really allows the participants or the population that we're interested in, which we call stakeholders, to be a part of developing the research, the program. They walk alongside of us. All the way. And in the experience-based co-design, what I really love about that methodology is that it includes the participants in the co-design at each and every stage, at each piece. And we constantly go back to them for their input to integrate their information, because what we're developing is for the population. So we really want their input in how we develop these programs.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to pivot a little bit to Dr. Wright about telling me more about this co-design idea. One of the things it responds to directly is this partisan care. So we know the process. Why is it important to incorporate the patient and the community in the research process, especially in the early stages?
Thank you. I really like that question because I think it gets to the heart of the matter. And in the most simple form, it's because it is outrageously arrogant to assume that we know what people actually want if we're not them. There's a lovely phrase of no decision about me without me. And I think even in the goal of patient-centered care, often what can happen is the patient is at the center, but no one's sort of, you can make a lot of decisions about someone while thinking about them. We aren't always very good at bracketing our biases. We can project. We have the thing of, well, what would I want? And there's that phrase of treat others the way you would want to be treated. And I don't know that that's always the best thing because others don't always want to be treated the way we do. You know, you have people from the same family who all want something different for themselves. And so the importance of having patients and families partnering with us from conception to conclusion of the work is because even along the way, so the co-design is not just for the clinical aspects of the care. They're co-designing with us about how do we adapt the research methodologies. So using, for example, the experience-based co-design approach, one of the things that we've been looking at is how do we adapt this methodology for different settings, for different populations, different conditions, different needs, so that the individuals involved feel truly included and not just a sort of case of often people talk about having the voices. And I think we work with some populations who no longer have voices. And so we want to have the whole body, the whole person working with us in this partnership as far as they want to. So we have a very flexible approach where people can step in and out at whichever phases they wish to. We use rolling recruitment to allow people to step out if they need to, but also covers for the fact that we are working with a population who may not survive the duration of the research program. And because a big piece that's come through and that I appreciate a lot from Drs. Wu and Sloan is the need for us to remain humble at all times and not make these assumptions on behalf of others that we often don't check. And things can sound really nice and sound like the right thing, but what I've found over sort of 19 years in healthcare and about 13 years of using this research approach is that when I do ask clinicians and researchers, what do you think it is that your population or the population you're serving want or came here for, they always miss something. When I then ask the patients and families, I've never found it where a group have got it completely right. And I think holding that piece of you don't know till you're in it. And even then, why not just ask? You know, most people are very happy to give their opinion when asked and included, and it can actually increase the trust that people have in us when we show that humility and say, look, we have this knowledge here and this skill set here, but we don't know you. You are the expert of you. They are the expert of their own experiences, and they may not know that expertise sometimes. So where we come in sometimes on the research side is helping to facilitate them. So offering spaces for people to think and process and work things out. David and Dr. Wu will share at some point coming up about the three-act model. And so that approach is built in through the research and the clinical side, as well as in our own PICAR meetings. We try and take this approach for ourselves too, of being very reflexive, very deliberate, very thoughtful. Quite a lot of sarcastic humor between us as well goes on. But really it comes to that piece of we don't know everything. We don't know what people really want. And there's been far too much assumptions that because we've had lots of experience, we must know what people want. And the point of palliative care where it fits so nicely with this is it's meant to be tailored to the individual. So this kind of allows us to do that, but look at it across a multitude of different settings, populations and groups, as I've said.
just listening to you talk, Dr. Wright, the words that are coming to mind is it must be a truly humbling process, but also kind, inclusive, and flexible process. And I can see now why you won that award, because so much thought goes into this. If I could get a real world example of maybe a question that arose in practice, Dr. Wu, about the PICAR research process, could you share with us an example that came your way, and what did you find?
One example is I was deeply impacted by a patient who was hospitalized for several months with congestive heart failure and a weak heart. I developed a very strong relationship with her. And one thing I noticed when I was in the room was that when the doctors and nurses came in, especially the doctors, their way of communicating with the patient was dehumanizing often. And after they would leave, she would tell me what she really thought of them, and that they weren't listening to her, and they were just telling her what they thought she should do. And then I would observe an environmental care worker come in and chat with her as if they were neighbors chatting across their fence, and sharing stories, and yes, sharing stories about the hospital staff, and which were the ones who treated her well and which were the ones who didn't. And I hate to say it, but often it was the doctors who were not communicating and treating her well. That left a deep impression on me. And as we went through multiple studies with different populations, for example, in the medical ICU, that theme actually came up recurrently, that the environmental care team was caring for the patients and families in a profound way. That resonated very much with my anecdotal experience. So we put our heads together as PICAR and came up with a project called Reimagining the Interdisciplinary Team to Address Health Disparities in Palliative Care. And reimagining the interdisciplinary team meant including environmental care and asking patients and families what their experiences were with environmental care, and asking environmental care what their experiences were interacting with patients and families. And then all together as a group, identifying improvement priorities that we might implement to highlight the strength of relationship and provide education throughout the healthcare system for the healthcare teams to realize that there is this rich, rich, profound relationship that is often happening between environmental care and our patients and families that we do not think about often and we do not really understand. And just to name that, the medical hierarchy, where often doctors sit at the top, can be very harmful in shutting down important voices like this, in marginalizing voices of our patients and families, especially from certain communities, and marginalizing folks on the healthcare team because of power dynamics and long existing hierarchy.
Dr. Wu, thank you. That was a very moving example, and I appreciate the work that you and your team are doing to recognize some of the historical errors, but more importantly, correcting it. And luckily on this team, I'm not sure if our listeners recognize we have experiences from medicine, nursing, and social work. And I'd love to hear from each of your perspective. Dr. Wright, starting with you, how do you think this idea of interprofessional collaboration is playing out with your team?
I think it's in a myriad of ways. I think the PICAR is now has grown as a group. We have two other of our wonderful nursing colleagues, Dr. Janice Taylor and Dr. Natalie Regeer, who joined us in the last couple of years. And we have a couple of former graduates of our Master's Entry to Nursing program who are active clinicians on Dr. Wu's team and also work with one works more closely on the research side too, Ashley Booth and Ben Roberts. I think a key piece for me is that there is, this is going to sound terrible, there is obviously the professional side where we do bring this range of experience, of background. We have completely different, we have overlapping scopes of practice, but unique expertise. This group really started because we like each other. We were connected through our former dean, Dr. Trish Davidson, and we found that we had a shared passion for improving care. We had a shared concern about the absence or exclusion of many groups from being actively involved in decisions about them, but we also had the same slightly broken sense of humor and a strong regard, respect, and delight in each other's company, I think. And it's kind of from my side, I think, shown how the interprofessional team is supposed to be, which is often the case. You do often see this in palliative care. It's a very inclusive approach because it's a holistic approach to care. And I think what's really nice is that our PICAR model mirrors that, but not just in a clinical setting, it crosses. And just to build on the piece that Dr. Wu mentioned about this environmental and supportive care staff piece, it's also been a really good way of learning that we need to never close our doors to who the team could be or should be. And one finding I really want to share from that study in terms of how impactful that has been, and speaking to this interprofessional piece, is the project was had addressing health equity in the title. That was a piece that we were really concerned about, but we weren't sure quite what the equity issue was. We just had picked up on it from other studies. And what we learned is that for patients who have life-limiting or serious illnesses and are in hospital for long periods of time, there can be this really interesting dichotomy of relationship where the relationship between patients and families and the clinical staff of nursing, medicine, allied healthcare professionals, it can deteriorate over time. And you hear phrases like patient not responding to treatment, and people, when they have these conditions, there isn't going to be an upward trajectory forever. Things dip, and clinicians can take that in a multitude of ways, but patients and families report this feeling of like, they're frustrated with me. I'm not responding the way that they want me to. This isn't happening the way they want it to. But conversely, with the EVC staff, who are also clinical staff, but in a slightly different way, there is an improvement in the relationship and an investment over time. They're the only group who don't ask anything from patients and families when they go in, they just give. And there is an investment in the human, in the person. And this was a direct quote from someone who said, this person, and it was, she was talking about one of the cleaners who was coming in, she said, this person reminded my daughter that she was still a human. Everyone else treated her like a medical problem. And so I think on the interprofessional piece, what PICAR has been really amazing for, in my understanding, is it stopped me getting lost in an ivory tower. It's kept my feet very firmly on the ground because there's a constant reminder that the hierarchies separate. And whilst they may be sensible in terms of accountability, patients, families, and EV staff felt like they were bottom of that hierarchy. And so they connected in a different way there too. And so there's things we may be missing out on when we're not inclusive, and perspectives and insights and understanding, and that trust is either broken or missing. And so I think my time in PICAR and working with Doctors Sloan and Wu, which makes me pause because I'm used to calling them D&D. So my time working with them has just been such a blessing and very humbling for a number of different reasons of working with them. They definitely keep my feet on the ground. But I think that that piece that friendships can flourish across profession isn't commonly known. There's often a focus on what do we learn from each other, but I think we learn because we like each other, or at least I like them. And that's that's how I take it.
If smiles could be translated to voices, I would like to let our listeners know that they definitely seem to like each other. And in all honesty, teams work better when people get along better. Social work is frequently not spoken about. And so I do want to highlight that. And I wanted to hear from you, Dr. Sloan. What is the role of social work in a team like this?
Thank you for the question. In a team like this, what is the role of social work? To make sure that other clinicians remain humble. But all jokes aside, you know, one of the things I really just want to add with to what Dr. David Wu and Rebecca Wright have said is that this team and the project that we worked on, Reimagining, I'm not going to say the entire name, that we came together to improve relationships between the patients and the hospital staff and physicians. We all know that often in institutions, especially where palliative care is concerned, that social workers are stretched very thin, if they exist at all. And this is just across all medical institutions. And so often social workers come in and they're not able to be with each patient like they may want to, like we are trained to. They're not able to do that. And so when we have the inclusion of the staff, the EVC, that fills in some of the relationship building that our social workers would normally do. And it helps the social workers to maybe when they do engage with the patients that they already know quite a bit and they have a feel for and they have a feel for how the patients have been treated and the way that they may be able to respond to the social worker and other team members. In other words, the relationship building piece has already been set and the trust building piece has already been set. Social work to this team, I am there to really just provide a lens through which we look through. And I think both Dr. Wu and Dr. Wright do an excellent job of this. And that is starting where our patients are, always remembering to start where our patients are and to meet them there and to help develop, you know, the programs to not only reduce disparities, but help meet the needs of all of our patients who are involved. And I think I just answered the question.
Thank you. I think you did. But more importantly, what I'm hearing from you is that although from different backgrounds, you're working towards making things better for the patients, the families, and community. So thank you all. You do incredibly way more work outside of this, but two more pieces I would love for you to tell me about. Dr. Wu, is this idea of the three-act model and Thrive by Design. These were specifically called out in your award from the American Hospital Association, your Circle of Life Award. What exactly are these two designs?
Sure, I would love to answer that. The three-act model is rooted in story and in our belief that story is a way for us to be, to quote you, Dr. Rodney, kind, inclusive, and flexible. I was an English major long before I was a doctor. And because I've always had a passion for stories, believing that stories are an entry point for us to be able to understand the experiences of others. With our patients and families, we designed the three-act model as a narrative, story-based approach to goals of care conversations. Ultimately, our mission is to match the care to what's important to our patient who is suffering with serious illness. And what we found is through this three-act model that we've been able to both practice and train providers in listening attentively and fluidly to the stories of our unique patients and families, and thereby tailor the care to what's important to them. So act one is we start by understanding the patient's story, and that includes their larger life context. It includes their understanding of the medical situation, and it includes the subtext, what's going on deep under the surface, the deep values, priorities, and emotions. Act two is sharing the medical situation in big picture terms. NAC3 is coming together to make shared decisions as we lay out the options in terms of both what was shared in Act 1 and what was shared in Act 2. And what we've done is integrated this across multiple programs now at Hopkins and published a series of papers showing that it's been effective in teaching trainees, a wider array of trainees, how to have these conversations and to be proficient at them in the classroom and with real patients and families, and to have an impact on clinical outcomes as well. Thrive by Design was born from my recognition as a leader in 2019 that there were worrisome signs for burnout in our team. And in palliative care, just as across healthcare, burnout is rampant. I realized as a leader that I needed to take this seriously and take a systematic approach to it. So we co-designed as a team this program called Thrive by Design that addresses wellness on three levels: systems, team, and personal. And just to illustrate a couple interventions that we co-designed as a team, one is Thrive by Arts, where monthly, instead of an education session or a team meeting, someone brings in an arts-based activity. It could be asking everyone to bring in their favorite song, and then we tell stories about why it's our favorite and talk about it as a group. It could be, believe it or not, sharing what we did on our summer vacation and bringing in pictures. It could be bringing in our director of community relations, Selwyn Ray, to share from his vast experience with our Black community, how we can better communicate with the elders in our community. The second piece of Thrive by Design I'll highlight is that professional development is a priority for all members of our team, not just the ones that have continuing education funds built into their contract, i.e. doctors, but for all professions on our team. And so we have taken that seriously. We've allocated funding for ongoing education for all members of our team. And some of the tangible fruits of that have been our chaplain attaining palliative specialty certification, our nurse going from nurse to nurse practitioner to palliative specialty boarded nurse practitioner through our support, as well as their personal excellence. So those are a couple of highlights of Thrive by Design. And the last thing I'll say is that those themes that we're talking about with PICAR, there are themes that run through all of these different programs, right? That story is important, that the unique voices of our patients, families, communities, and each other are deeply important, that co-design is a critical way forward if we're going to really move the healthcare system in a powerful and beneficial way.
Thank you so much. Those are very powerful words. And I think many persons would want to work with a team like yours. But also specifically to those two programs, those are principles that would be useful to education, clinical work, and research. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Thank you all for putting such heart into the end-of-life care, especially at a time where it's difficult. Your work truly matters. Time is of the essence, and we don't necessarily always have the time to wait. For our listeners, you can read more about the palliative care program at Bayview in the Helpful, Powerful, and Kind Palliative Care blog on our On the Pulse blog. And I want to say a special thank you to all of our guests, Dr. Sloan, Dr. Wu, and Dr. Wright. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Been an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of On the Pulse. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share with someone you know and subscribe through Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. You can also find us at the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com/nurse. Be sure to also check out our On the Pulse blog. You can learn more about the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing at nursing.jhu.edu.